Welcome to episode 457. What on earth is going on with our medical system? The USA, Australia, and the UK are the fattest, the sickest, and the most unwell that we've ever been. Yet these countries are extremely wealthy, pour billions and trillions of dollars into healthcare, and somehow, with all of this fancy medicine, science, and technology, everyone is getting worse. How is that? Well, that's what we talk about today, with a doctor that chose to sidestep the dogmatic approach to drug-driven sick care and question and challenge the system, and instead promote true healing methods. In this conversation, we go down some rabbit holes that less researched people might call conspiracies. We talk about who pays for all of the scientific research, why governments seem to have a vested interest in producing more sick people, why focusing on your blood results doesn't really solve the problem, and whether or not Robert Kennedy Jr., RFK, is a legitimate beacon of hope for the health of the USA and the rest of us here in the Western world. This is a big conversation and you might need to listen twice. So, let's get into it.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Another day, another brain-altering conversation is waiting to happen. Now, the business end of things is that this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on the scale. And so for those that are beyond mildly interested in that conversation, the link to book a call with myself or my team is down in the show notes below or the caption down there as well. So if you'd like to learn more about our real weight loss programs, scroll down, click the link, book in a conversation. Now, to today's conversation that I said is going to be mind-altering. So we're having that conversation with Dr. Andy Lazarus, who is a medical doctor, a physician practicing primary care and geriatric medicine in Maryland in the US of A. Now, he won the position of Baltimore top doc multiple years running and regularly writes scholarly articles about our healthcare system, working to make it more sensible for patients and the doctors that work in that system. He's written multiple books, including Curing Medicare and most recently, A Return to Healing, which was co-authored by Dr. Alan Roth. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great being here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this because I think the kind of work that you do, it feels like a dangerous topic to a lot of people, doctors, and it's quite divisive, politically speaking. And so the fact that you're here and you want to talk about this stuff excites me for what we're about to sort of unravel.
And you're right. It is something that breaks the mold of what people think the medical system is and should be. And especially in my country, especially the people who are profiting from that medical system like to have a different narrative. So I do push against that narrative. Absolutely.
Well, and I guess with that narrative, and there's no doubt that in the US and particularly Australia, and I guess a lot of the progressive Western world really, that our healthcare system is cooked, to say the least, and seems to be getting worse and producing more and more patients rather than making them all better. And so I'm curious for you, like when you first realized on your journey as a medical professional that something was fundamentally broken in the way that the sort of main care or mainstream medicine approaches patient care.
I mean, I was lucky. I went to a really good medical school that did a lot of community work, and that was its main focus. And I worked with a lot of doctors who questioned the medical system. So I got to see right early on. I remember once I tried to set up a group of students to go into the South Bronx, which is a very impoverished area in New York, and do blood pressure screening. And we invited this famous blood pressure doctor there. And he got up there, about 80 students I was able to recruit. And he said, "All of you are wasting your time." He said, "It's all about nutrition. It's all about exercise. This is a food desert. If we put our efforts into helping people eat better and take care of themselves and reduce stress, there wouldn't be a problem. But all you're going to do is check people's blood pressure, tell them they should take medicine, which they can't afford anyway, not give them a system." And that opened my eyes because here I set up this big thing and he destroyed it, but in the best of ways. And I think all of us learned a lot from that. And he was absolutely right.
I'm curious what needs to be different about you and maybe me, but the people that listen to that, because I think the way that science and medicine, especially from an education standpoint, is presented to us is that it's superior. And the idea that nature, the implication within that is that nature is an outdated system that we're now smarter than. So often doctors and scientists, intelligent people, reject ideas about nutrition or the simplicity of healing that comes from those ideas. So what do you think it is within yourself that makes you receptive to that and not attached to the idea that science and medicine is the much more intelligent AI version of nature?
I mean, you have to look at the history of science. And I'm a historian. I'm actually getting a master's degree at my old age in history.
That's cool.
And I'm doing the history of medicine. Just look at science and what it's done. I mean, our medical science has created racial science and eugenics, and those were the absolute right answers, and there is no questioning them. And anyone who questioned them was considered a misinformer. We did forced sterilizations in this country. We had a big syphilis experiment where we infected African Americans with, we didn't infect them with syphilis, but we didn't treat them. We wanted to watch the natural progression over decades and let them die. That's what science has done. So you have to look at science through the lens of, as Einstein said, of it always needs to be questioned. And if science isn't questioned, if science becomes dogma, then it's religion. And unfortunately, medical science has become a religion. You have to do it a certain way. And the liturgy is created by drug company studies. And that's all we have, at least in this country. We have drug company studies. So what? I have two kids in medical school, so I see what they're being taught. My daughter is very interested in nutrition. She's in medical school. She said, "Dad, we just had our nutrition segment. It was 2 weeks long, and they didn't mention one item of food." So
what did they mention?
They talked about how carbohydrates are digested, how fats are digested, not actual food. And I mean, I've given talks. I remember giving a talk about the real barometer of heart disease is whether cholesterol sticks to blood vessels. It's not what your cholesterol is. Who cares about that? And what makes it stick is inflammation. What causes inflammation? Bad diet, stress, no exercise. And I gave this talk to a bunch of doctors, and I said, we got to talk about it. And one guy looked up, put up his hand and said, just like this, blah, 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 blah. I've heard it all before. Look, we don't have time for this. They don't care. I put them on a statin cholesterol medicine. I win, they win. And it's a lot much quicker visit. And unfortunately, that's been my field. And those are the people I often confront. And that's just not who I am.
Yeah, it's interesting because, and we touched on this before we hit record, but you mentioned dogma and religion. And I think we really saw in the COVID period of time, science really become scientism in that idea that literally people were on the streets and in households fighting for science, for medicine, for these ideas that were just told to them by somebody else, like not personally researched. And sure, we should be able to trust the people we look up to. But it was interesting because there was this massive divide of people that started to realize, oh, my doctor is just somebody else that went to school and got educated by someone that they didn't know, and they didn't fact check their education. And then the other group of people were religious warriors. Many wars have been started over religion. And it's like we started to see the scientism wars really begin in the public eye during COVID.
It was that way, certainly in our country. And it became that we had a guy named Anthony Fauci, you may have heard of him, and I've studied his career for 30 years, so I know him very well. But yeah, anything he said became fact. Those of us in the trenches, and I took care of 2,000 plus people with COVID right from day one. And we saw what worked. We read data from Europe, but it went against what he was saying, what our CDC was saying. And yeah, I actually, because I said something once, which was just a fact, I got a letter saying my medical license was under review. I just stated a fact that was going on in one of the nursing homes I worked in. And I tried to treat patients with basic common sense treatments that were learned about in Italy, which hit right before we got hit, that actually I lost very few patients during COVID because of these treatments. And I got yelled at for that too, because it wasn't in the liturgy. So yes, science is not science when one guy is saying, and Fauci said, I am science. And people who march across and say they're experts, I don't trust, because who is an expert? No one's an expert. Einstein would not have considered himself an expert in his own relativity theory. And he says anyone who calls himself an expert, you better turn away from. And unfortunately, there were a lot of experts saying, this is what you got to do. I'm not going to tell you why. And that's part of, it's kind of, I say it was our medical system on steroids, because that's what our whole medical system is. It's just a lot of things that you're supposed to believe and not ask where they came from. And unfortunately, they all lead to more tests, drugs, procedures, and no one talks about diet because that's not where the money is. In fact, I read a blog recently that was sent to me, not even in jest. It was from a medical group, and it said, is wellness bad for the healthcare system? And their answer was
article.
Yes. It was yes.
Yeah.
Of course it is. Of course it's bad. If everyone's healthy, that I always say our business model is to make sure you're not healthy. So that's kind of what the healthcare system's doing. And unfortunately, when that gets equated to science, it really desecrates the word science. And we saw that. Absolutely.
Does that sort of culture that's embedded in this sort of medical field, but also now, you know, now quite beyond the boundaries of a medical professional field, and now it's very much in the public conversation about science and medicine, and you don't have anything valid to say unless you say there's a study that proves that. Is, you mentioned in what you were saying before, we've got drug company studies.
Right.
Is that what sort of, I guess, that is that the narrative creator, that all of the science comes from people that are significantly financially invested in the outcome of the science?
Yeah, I mean, and this started a long time ago in our country. In our book, we talk about studies that occurred back in the 1950s that were completely manipulated. Believe it or not, that back then it was the food industry that was doing much of the manipulation. The sugar lobby was very strong in this country between the 50s and the 70s, and they bribed a lot of people. What was shocking to me is how little they had to pay to get these Harvard guys to write the articles they wanted to write. But we know all this now. We know this was all manipulated, and yet we're still talking about it. And yes, every study, I think it's 98% of clinical studies are either paid for, they're at least paid for by drug companies, but they might even be written and directed by drug companies. There was a guy in Harvard recently, a guy named Abramson, who's a primary care doctor, who wrote an article and said basically all a lot of his colleagues who were writing articles in big journals like New England Journal of Medicine have not seen their articles until they're actually printed. They're actually written by the drug company. So yeah, I mean, we talk about this in our book a lot. We talk about how the drug companies pay for our federal agencies in our country, the CDC, which tells us what to do during crises like COVID, the FDA, which is what allows new drugs to come in the market, are almost 100% financed by drug companies, and are on their boards are ex-executives from drug companies. So this is, and we show even like the American Diabetes Association, American Cancer Society, they're all paid for primarily by drug companies. So the narrative becomes consistent because all these people are saying the same thing. So people believe it. And it sounds like science if everyone's believing it.
Yeah. And then I think as well, which is coincidentally a conversation I had with clients just last night, but there's the intelligence bias, right? We all like to believe we're intelligent beings, and therefore the more complex the information, if I can understand that, then, oh, it makes sense because I'm a smart person, right?
Exactly. You're exactly right about that. And I think a lot of doctors play into that. The doctors themselves speak in a language of infallibility. Well, I see that all the time. And they say, this is what you have to do. If you don't do it, you're going to die. Or if they get to you right in time, they say, I saved your life. Good thing you came up here just in the nick of time. You waited one more minute, you were going to be dead. And they suck in, and then you believe it because here's this trustworthy doctor in the white coat, and everyone trusts doctors, and he's such a nice guy. I remember my dad always telling me, I said, yeah, but Andy's such a nice guy. I said, but dad, he's an idiot. I said, I don't care if he's a nice guy. But, you know, you get taken in by this. And unfortunately, the doctors are giving you the easy answer. Take this pill, you're saved, right? That's the easy answer. That's what you want to hear. And we talk a lot about this in our book. The basis of treatment effect is fixing a number. You could fix a cholesterol number. You could lower your PSA, you know, blood test with cancer, prostate cancer. But you can even lower your A1C with diabetes, but are you helping anyone? That's irrelevant, because if we're not actually lowering the cause of diabetes, if we're just lowering the sugar, we've helped absolutely no one. But doctors give you the easy approach, and people love that. You know, their number's better. The doctor's telling them they're doing great. All they got to do is take this drug. Life is good. They could eat whatever they want. They could do whatever they want. So yeah, that's why in our country, we are spending over $4 trillion for healthcare right now. 20 years ago, it was 500 billion. So it was 1/8. We are living shorter than we did then. And we have many more chronic diseases. All of a sudden, everyone's sick. Everyone's got a chronic disease. So why is that? No one asked this question, what's gone wrong here? But we're just creating more illness and more death as we spend more money. But it's not all bad because there are a lot of people making some money. So we got to look at the bright side.
Well, off the back of that, in regards to money, I remember reading an article when I was sort of scouring through PubMed, and it was a written article as opposed to a journal article, but it was talking about the fact that they did a 2022, the review was done in 2024, but they reviewed top papers that were released in 2022, and they were able to equate, according to this particular research, and it was an investigative journalist, $1 billion that were paid directly to peer reviewers. And peer reviewers are meant to be what gives a study its validity in the marketplace. You hear people say, peer-reviewed study, this many people have peer-reviewed it, only to find out that $1 billion US, and that was just the studies they looked at, which was a lot, but it wasn't all of them. So arguably there's more money. And it's like, who is paying peer reviewers? It's like, one, the study is funded by the drug company. Then the drug company pays the people that look at the research as well.
Right.
And it's like, there's just layers and layers of people being paid off, which is just wild because people hear the terms like being paid or paid off. And they think it's like the CIA paying some secret person. And it's like, oh, it's probably a doctor.
Yeah, it probably is. And you do get a lot of money from doing that. But just remember too, that the doctors who are generally picked for peer review are academic doctors who are probably doing another study with the same drug company. And they're not going to say anything bad about it. And the journal, the New England Journal, gets most of its revenue from drug companies, from drug company ads. And then the FDA that's going to approve the drug, the approval process is 100% funded by drug companies. And that was a law that was passed under the Clinton administration, actually, to save the government a little money. But of course, it costs the government a lot more money because now we're approving every drug out there. We just approved a dementia drug that costs $50,000 a year and has absolutely no proven benefit, but it does cause bleeding in the brain. Now, you may think that's
amazing,
a bad outcome, but for the medical system, that's a good outcome because it's more work for the medical system. But when that thing was approved, there were people on the FDA who actually went against it and it didn't pass the first time. Somehow those people retired and other people came in and then it was approved. And so it almost sounds like, I always say when I talk, I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but God knows we document all this in our book and it has been documented over and over again by many people. That this is what's going on. But it doesn't seem, and what's frustrating is it doesn't seem to move anyone's opinions. People still are very trusting of the system and of the doctors and of even these academic doctors who are getting paid to do peer reviews and drug company studies. It seems that when they walk across CNN or some news station, people believe them. They're from Harvard or Hopkins or some famous place. And they say, well, how could we not believe this guy? But yeah, this is the reality. And it sounds like we're telling some kind of wild tale, but this is the way our system is built. And it is built in a way that will profit a lot of people.
Yeah. In my experience, these stories sound the most wild and the most ridiculous to people that have never done their own homework or research. And usually those people are also the most triggered and the most angry when you bring up controversial topics because I guess their worldview or their understanding of reality is being rocked in a way that makes them feel unsafe or like they've been lied to. And so they vehemently oppose what's being said.
I think you're right. I think they do feel like they've bought into this and they don't want to be told that they're wrong. I mean, they put all their faith into this system and they've chosen to take the easy, I call it the easy road of pills and tests. You think nutrition and exercise is the actual easy road because it's not that hard to do. If you do it right, it actually is wonderful, but it doesn't give you that quick response. There's a new fellowship. So in our country, when we get trained, we go for residency and then we could do a fellowship. So you want to be a cardiologist, you do cardiology. There's a new one called lifestyle medicine. And I said, this is amazing. So I went to a couple lectures and they were just speaking the same language as all these medical societies. It was all about lowering numbers. And I called one of them and I said, I put people on good diets and their cholesterol doesn't budge. And I tell them not to worry. I said, I don't even want to check the cholesterol, but they make me do it and it doesn't budge. Yeah. And they say, God, maybe this diet's not working. I said, no, it's the inflammation. We're trying to fix the inflammation. We don't want the cholesterol to stick. Well, how do you measure that? Well, you can't. I said, I can't measure it, but I could tell you it's going to work. I said, it's worked for eons. All the country, all the places in the world where people live the longest, this is what they do. They don't take drugs. They don't do tests. They don't see doctors. They do this. I said, it's going to work. You have to have faith in something you can't measure. And that also blows people away. Sometimes you can get an improvement in something, but you'll get a bigger improvement if you go on a cholesterol medicine, right? That's going to really drive it down, but you're not lowering inflammation. So you're not actually helping anything. You're just making a number look good, but people love that. And so, yes, when you tell them this is not true, they get very upset. And when they go to their cardiologist, I've had cardiologists tell patients, yeah, I know that guy. He's a nut job. When they're talking about me, that's what you kind of become, right? You become this guy who's the nut job because you go, and all the other doctors agree with the cardiologist. So it's the same thing. It's luckily I have patients who totally trust me at this point for their, whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But they at least know that I'm trying to help them. I'm not trying to play some game. I have no monetary advantage for them to eat well. It doesn't help me. Whereas a cardiologist has a big monetary advantage if you get a stent. I don't have any of that. So maybe that's why they trust me a little bit. But I think going down this road of holistic medicine and pushing away from drugs and tests and numbers has really helped a lot of them feel better. So I say, your numbers may not be better, but how do you feel? They say, I feel great. I said, okay, that's pretty good. Your body's telling you something. I mean, you feel great. Your body's saying those medicines were not making you feel great. And I think you're going to be fine. And I think, again, when they start believing in that, that helps too. Because faith in what you're doing makes a big difference. Also, the old placebo effect works for medicines, but I think it works for everything because it raises your serotonin. It lowers your dopamine. It just makes you feel better. And I think that's part of it. So yeah, this other path, which by the way, we talk about the origins of our healthcare system, which started in 1911. This other path was alive and well back then. Just like people were building electric cars in 1911, they were also building systems based on doctors who actually speak with patients instead of just ordering a bunch of tests and trying to do a holistic approach. William Osler, who's our book's hero, was one of the founders of Hopkins. And it's only when he retired that they went down this road, because he was such a powerful voice. But this is what he preached. He was very against corporate medicine. He was all about, he said, if you could eat your way to health, eat your way to health. And he said, if you have a problem and you take a medicine, now you have two problems. So, I mean, that was a path we could have taken, but we had a lot of people who were not interested in that path. And I think we could easily get back on it. It wouldn't be too hard if people had some faith in it.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar, and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too, which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, that's part of the mission of this podcast and the work that I do and why I left the cancer industry, because I thought, yeah, I can do a lot more good in the world by, guiding people onto a path of, whole real food, eating better, living better, because then it's highly likely that you won't end up in the cancer hospital rather than working with people that are already in that situation per se. And I just got sick of having arguments with hospital dietitians. that went on for a while before I quit. But the question that I think often comes up in this topic is, why would the government want its own people to be sick? right? And I default to the, it's not about people being sick, it's about everybody getting paid.
Right.
But at some point, the American empire, the US empire is going to collapse because everybody is fat, sick, and dying. And it's workforce and it's everything that it's got to offer. And there's even conversations about the US military being more unfit and overweight than it's ever been. And that extends to Australia. We have a very obese population over here as well. So that's the question that often comes up is like at the root of it. Like, why would governments not do everything they could to have a healthy, strong, and war-able like body of humans?
And I think it comes down to, at least in our country, unless there's a catastrophe, people don't want to budge. And again, not to harp on the drug companies and the medical specialty societies, but they're paying a lot of money to our congressmen and women and to the media. The media in our country is heavily financed by them, the same group. They're very smart people, these companies. And I think enough people also believe the narrative that they're selling, that people are getting better. If you look at, for instance, ads for diabetes medicines, they'll say how much they'll lower the A1C. We can cure all this stuff. This is great. We got drugs. But no one's asking the question, why do we have so much diabetes to begin with? That started when we went on these low-fat diets and started eating more sugar and white flour and not enough plants, low-carb diets as well, where we get rid of all the fiber, fruits and vegetables. And that's doctors preached all that stuff. And, you know, all of a sudden we're having more inflammatory diseases that, well, look at this, we have drugs for this. And so it actually creates a feedback where people think they're getting better, even though we're all getting worse. And it's a weird phenomenon that I have to live with because everyone tells me, yeah, but we're living longer. You must be wrong. I said, actually, we're not. But even if we were, we're all sick. Everyone's got multiple illnesses now. And that just was never the case before. I always point to the founding fathers of our country. Their average lifespan was 85 years. And that was back in the day before when people were dying of infectious diseases left and right. They seem to do okay without all these drugs and stents and tests and everything. They, of course, they need processed food back then. So it's a very different situation. But yeah, I think the government will, if it hits, it's like kind of like global warming. If a crisis occurs, people are going to have to do something. Until then, they're just going to talk about it. And there are people talking about it, but no one's doing anything.
Yeah, one of the flaws, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that one of the flaws in the argument for we're living longer, things must be better because of all of this science and medicine is true, but it's maybe misguided in what people mean by it. Because my understanding is the reason that the life expectancy age went up is because we stopped babies dying during childbirth. And so if you stop a very large number of extremely young people dying, that by mathematically means that the median age goes up.
Right. We have this chart in our book, which basically says, back in the day, half the kids died. For a few births, mothers tended to die. So you just take those people out of the equation because we are better at treating infectious disease, although we go overboard on that too, but we're better. We understand you shouldn't drink water someone's had a bowel movement in. We just have some better sense of that. And if you just take that out, we're not living any longer than we lived couple hundred years ago. So it's that is exactly why we're living longer. It has nothing to do with all these medicines that people are taking those later in life. And that since we've been doing stents and statins and all these stress tests, heart disease has gone up. So it's just such an assault on common sense to think this is all working. That's what drives me crazy. We even have a chapter in the book called Whatever Happened to Common Sense, because it seems to have dissolved. People just When I say that to people, they say to me, well, that's one opinion. And I'm like, well, actually, it has gone up and we're spending this money and heart disease has gone up. I mean, that's not an opinion. So, but they want it to be an opinion. Like you said, no one wants to be wrong. They've gone down this path. They've had their poor stents and they're on high dose cholesterol medicines and they can't walk anymore, but they think they're doing okay. So I think that's part of the problem is this. So this belief that we're living longer is really what they cling to. And if you try to tear that apart the way you did, which is accurate, they don't like it. Nobody likes that. Again, that's the religion. That's the religion of medicine. You don't want to bring down the God concept. And once Galileo showed the way the planets actually move, he was put in jail. You just don't want to. You don't want to do that. And people don't like when we talk this way.
Yeah. I've even had to take one of my podcast episodes down because the US government was basically suing the guest for making claims about how natural health and food and medicine can help them. Like, so it's like, and I've been subject to lots of backlash over the years from leaving conventional cancer hospital work and sort of going into the alternative space, a little bit more natural, more food-based supplement lifestyle. And yeah, you get ridiculed. And actually, I'm glad that I was at a young enough age that that ridicule meant that it shaped my personality in a way that meant that I can now accept that I might always be wrong. And so that was a really beneficial process to go through, because now I think I've still got an ego, I'm a human, but I'm not like so attached to what I'm doing that someone couldn't come along with better data or better evidence and me just totally deny it. I'm hopeful that wouldn't happen.
If it did happen with what you talk about, it would tear apart a couple, many thousands of years of what we know is actually good for you. So
yeah,
that's why we know that's not going to happen. I mean, there might be some details about whether seed oils are better or worse than this and that, but the details are not the important thing. That does change over time, but that's science, right? Science is being willing to look yourself in the mirror and say you're wrong,
yeah,
and go down another road. And that to be truly a scientific person means you'll also listen to other people's opinions, take them seriously, look them up, see what you can do about them. That's not, we don't see much of that in the medical field, but I would like to think, like you, I'd like to think I'm like that. And I'd be more than willing to change if someone could show me that I'm going down a wrong road.
Yeah. And maybe the failing here is the outdated school system. We're raised from such a young age. And that, as we know, the conventional schooling was designed to produce factory workers that just followed the orders of their master, so to speak. And so maybe this whole cultural psychological acceptance of the authoritarian approach is half the problem because of this relationship, because doctors are put on this pedestal and medicine, yes, and research and statistics and studies. And we all went to school, so we want to be good little boys and girls so we don't get our lashings. And so maybe the cultural problem begins in school. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I 100% agree with you. Many philosophers would agree with you. You probably have heard of Foucault and Bentham, who basically said school is designed to make you a good citizen to a society that wants you to be a certain way. And that society is a society that, again, it's a profit motive. They want you to be good little dutiful citizens of the country and to say yes to people who are in power. School does that. Medical school's worse. Medical school, truly, it's a multiple choice experience, I call it. Where you have to take a bunch of multiple choice tests for things that are so nuanced and subtle that there's no way there could be one right answer. But they're teaching you there's always one right answer. And they're also teaching you you're an expert and that you're the person who's going to save everyone's life. And you have to act a certain way and think a certain way and talk a certain way. And you always have to use words that people don't understand. That's crucial. But yeah, you leave medical school thinking you're all that. Osler also said, he said, the young doctor prescribes 20 drugs for every problem and the old doctor prescribes one drug for 20 problems. And what he's trying to say is that as we become more experienced, we become less arrogant because we realize how much we don't know. So a lot of the older doctors do kind of back off a little bit, but you know, that the younger doctors, especially, they come out of medical school thinking they know everything. And unfortunate because they learn their lesson on real human beings, that they don't know everything. And yeah, it's schooling. Schooling, again, the medical school system we have now was created in 1911 to create research institutions that would make money for the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations back then. I mean, we haven't changed the medical system since 1911 in our country. So we're still doing... People are going in there and not seeing patients basically for 2 years and just sitting in a classroom, not knowing what they're learning, and then see patients only in a hospital after that. So they go out into the world and they have no idea what real patients are like or what real problems are like. They don't learn the socioeconomic problems that affect people. I don't think too many medical students would even know what a food desert is and the fact that people in certain areas can't get certain foods. It's just not taught. It's just not important. So yeah, the schooling, if we change that, and that's one of our solutions that we propose in the book, is a reformation of the school back to the way it was when Osler was at Hopkins. And back then, people were with patients from day one, and then they went to class to learn about what they saw. So you see it in a real person, then you learn the science of that after you actually see it. So you go, and these were people actually in the community. Community doctors were teaching them. So it was a much more realistic experience, and it mixed the science and the humanism together, which the current school doesn't do.
Yeah, so interesting. And I was laughing a little bit there when you were talking about it, the fact that this hierarchy is a little worse in medical school. But I just think about working in the hospital, being on the ward, and like you don't question the consultant, and there's this very strict hierarchy, and it's like all the little junior doctors, all the little minions and scientists running around, like, do as you're told, stay awake for 18 hours, do all of the crazy things to get your brownie points.
We had different size white coats depending on how high up we were in the hierarchy. That's the guys who had those white coats down to their knees, you always deferred to those guys. But as medical students, that barely hit our waist. Slowly they went lower and lower, and you kind of knew where you stood based on your white coat.
That's so interesting. I'm curious how, because one thing that I began my little journey of trying to have a little positive impact on the world, and I was really sort of in activist mode with a lot of the information in your book and that you talk about. And after going on my own deep dive down the Rockefeller and Rothschild and at the beginning of the banks and the medicine and the oil and all of that stuff, and I got really sort of fired up in a way that was probably just a lot of people wanted to avoid me. And then I realized because I didn't have $1 trillion to fight these systems on their level, I had to figure out a path to be able to empower the individual to make different choices. And so that's what I'm trying to do now. But my question to you is, for those individuals listening, what is the way that we can begin to empower them to change this culture or this hierarchy that's going on with medicine and doctors, with the belief, I guess the fundamental belief in there, that we're possibly being led in the wrong direction?
I think it's really important, and we talk about this a lot, that it be done on the individual level. And you're right. Fighting the system, you're going to lose. I mean, the system is powerful. As a cousin of mine said, you know, we have congressional districts. I don't know if you guys have similar thing where each little area has a congressperson who's in charge of it. And in every congressional district in our country, there's a hospital. And the hospital is the most stable employer of that district. And there's not a single person in the government that's going to do anything that's going to put that in jeopardy. So you go. So for so many levels, you try to fight this system from the top, it's going to be a frustrating battle. But I always tell my patients, I said, you got to question everything. They say, well, then I'm a bad patient. And that's kind of, I talk a lot about the hospital, because if you question things in the hospital as a patient, they really make you feel like you're the worst human being in the world. I said, good. I said, embrace that. I said, you're fighting for yourself. I said, so the doctor needs to prove what the doctor's doing. The default should be to do as little medical intervention as possible. And for them to do medical intervention, they have to be very compelling. The problem is the statistics that they throw at you. Sometimes they'll pull out little calculators. These are all protocol statistics. And again, as people have said, when they talk about computers and AI, the more junk you put in, the more junk you get out. And the studies being used for these things are all the drug company studies. So, you know, they're going to quote you statistics that'll scare you. But you have to push back, and you just have to question it. And you could always, there's very little in the medical world in terms of intervention that you need to do right away. Even if your blood pressure's high, you got time. And you could say, look, I'm going to try diet for a while. And the doctor says, that's not going to work. I'm going to try it. And then it's just finding a good nutritionist or finding a book. I mean, there's so much out there on how to eat well. A lot of great people writing books about it, a lot of podcasts. So you could work on that and see what you can do. I've had patients who I diagnose awful diabetes. They come in, their sugars are 450, 500 out of the blue. And I say, what do you want to do? They say, can you give me 2 months? I'm going to see what I can do. I say, absolutely. You got 2 months. But if you get sick, let me know. But let's see what you can do. I give them some advice about how to eat. But that should be the default, right? The default should be, let's see what I could do. Because it turns out that more than 50% of health outcomes are determined by what we do. And less than 7% are determined what doctors do. And the doctors make their most impact when you're really sick. Like when you get in a car accident, your appendix ruptures. Well, all the medicines, it has such a small impact, but you have a huge impact. So I always tell patients, try that first. All you got time. Even if your sugar's bad, you got time. It takes years and years before these things affect you. So see what you can do. And I think that should be the default, is less medicine, less intervention, more holistic changes. And do not count on the doctor to tell you what you should be eating or doing. Because at least in my country, they don't know. They might actually make things worse if they tell you what to eat. So you got to go to other sources.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what you've said. And it leads me to ask a question. Having worked in cancer, it appears that a significant amount of profit and finance and employment opportunity, and therefore a significant part of most countries' GDP, is Western and mainstream medicine. And so, like you said, the system's impossible to fight because of those reasons. And for those reasons also, it's highly politicized. But I guess if you had to sort of distill it down to why our system is so focused on managing diseases rather than curing them, like, is it just the finance? And I guess the second to that is, like, are there any countries that have successfully structured their healthcare systems to actually prioritize prevention?
I mean, I think some of the Scandinavian countries have done a fairly good job. And it's funny because even during COVID, they did things differently than we did, and they did a much better. You guys came out high as of how well you did in COVID, but that came with a price. You guys were locked up and other things. In Sweden, they weren't. They went to school, they did everything, and they came and tied with you guys. So they took a much more scientific, holistic approach, and they do that in general. They have a much more holistic approach to healthcare. Their national healthcare system is much more focused on prevention. It's definitely doable. It's funny because we don't look to models of countries like that. Of course, a country like that is where the government's paying a lot of money, wants to save. We don't have the same incentive to save money as a country like Sweden, which is why a lot of people want a national healthcare system in this country, which is never going to happen. But yeah, by managing chronic diseases rather than curing them, that is what keeps the system purring along. Curing them would be awful. There's always this conspiracy that we could cure cancer if we wanted to. What would that do for all these people who are profiting off it? I've never seen evidence of that, but I do think we could prevent cancer, a lot of cancers, if we right away started eating better and not in plastic bottles and all the metals in our food and God knows what else is making this uptick in cancer. But it's environmental and it's what we put in our body, what we're exposed to. So yeah, if we really wanted to do that, that would be a national priority. And it certainly isn't. So, I mean, I agree that there must be some reason that people want it to be this way. And I can only think of profit. It comes down to money, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I'm with you on that. With the political landscape in the US at the moment, which really for us in Australia is heavily in our news and our information and our social media, do you have hope for the American healthcare system and thus, I guess, for the Western world with Robert Kennedy Jr., RFK, being in there? Because he very much appears to the holistic natural health side of people as being the hope that America needs in regards to its health.
Like that. And Kennedy appointed, I'll botch up his name, Jay Baca, and I don't remember his name. He's a Stanford academic who came up with a document during COVID that talked about an alternative approach and was signed by over 1 million doctors and scientists. But he's in the NIH now. And the two of them, I followed them forever. And they're all about holistic health, getting the pharmaceutical companies out. But even the guy, we have kind of a quackish guy in Medicare, running our Medicare system, which is our old age healthcare system, our only real national system, named Dr. Oz. And he's a TV personality, but I know people work there. And he says, look, let's see what you guys can do so we could pay more for nutrition programs, because that's what we got to do. We hear this now. And of course, our media is just destroying these people, just basically calling them anti-vax. And that's the only thing they could say to them, that they're anti-vax. And Kennedy has made some comments about vaccines that can be interpreted many different ways. And I always say, well, his kids were vaccinated, and he's much about health choice and that any vaccine needs to be proven to work.
Yeah.
He's not exactly an anti. I say he's a vaccine skeptic, and I call myself a skeptic about everything. I said, if you're not a skeptic, you're not a scientist. You have to be a skeptic.
Yeah.
So they're just lashing at him. And so a lot of my patients just say, oh, that quack Kennedy. I always say, well, do you know what he stands for? Yeah, he wants to ban all vaccinations. So they're doing a clever job of just trying to make him look like an idiot.
Mm.
His basic idea, unfortunately, is not Trump's. So there might come a clash. He's even made fun of the way Trump eats, and you don't do that to Trump. I think Trump made him eat McDonald's the next day. There was a video of that where Kennedy had to eat McDonald's. Has anyone seen what Kennedy looks like? He's an older guy. I mean, the guy's ripped, and he's great health. I mean, and he has it right. And yeah, if he has the power to make changes, things will go in the right direction. And we actually wrote a little article about that. His six pillars of good health, we agree with all six, you know, and most of them are about prevention and getting away from all these drugs and having real science done by a national organization instead of drug companies. So maybe, but he's up against a huge wall. So whether he can make any dent, we don't know. That'll be interesting because it's the first time in my lifetime someone's been in power who actually wants to do these things that we've all wanted to do. And if he can't do it, then we'll go back to just doing it on the individual patient by patient level. Because if he can't do it, no one's going to be able to do it.
Well, I mean, one thing I learned going through my little activist phase of sort of being anti-pharma many years ago was that when you sort of smash the information into people's faces, you really push them a long way away. And so at the very least, hopefully having Kennedy there, and sure, there's all the political narratives that are thrown against him and the media campaigns, but hopefully it just plants a seed for people.
Maybe.
It just plants that seed at the very least.
Because when I tell people what he stands for, they all say, yeah, I agree with all that. And I say, well, then let's give him a chance. I said, so let's see what happens. I said, you want nutrition. I said, you eat really well and you're healthy. And, you know, we want everyone to do that. People in inner cities should have the same right to eat well. We pay in this country last year, we paid $35 billion for drugs to help you lose weight. And the Ozimbics and the Wegovys. Mm. And by the way, those drugs are scary stuff in terms of especially long-term outcomes. You imagine we put that money into food deserts and we put it into nutrition programs? I mean, the whole world would change if we put those two drugs, if we put that money into those kind of things, even a fraction of that money, we could change the world. So it wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take much to do it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the Ozempic's going wild at the minute. I did a podcast episode, and for anyone that wants to check it out, episode 429, but very, very rapidly, it was one of my most downloaded episodes in a day because the first words in it are Ozempic warning.
Right.
And I just go through the possible side effects, and I've got plenty of clients that used to be on it, and like, oh, the weight loss, the desperation for weight loss. But I agree, that amount of money into solving food problems and farming problems and accessibility problems would, a single generation would totally transform the health landscape.
It would. And and we have that money, obviously, because we're paying for those. And we're going to be paying a lot more for the side effects of these drugs. So it's what we call the downstream cost of these drugs is going to be immense. But that's true of a lot of drugs. And you're talking about a $4 trillion system in our country. It wouldn't take but a few billion to really make a dent in places that need nutritional help. Like you say, in farming help and even just nutrition education. It wouldn't take much, but we put zero into that. So it's just that wall is the one we really have to surmount if we're going to get anywhere. We have to at least put something into it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And for anybody that's listening that thinks, oh, Andy's interesting and I want to check out his book and hang out with him on the internet or find, you know, what you're all about, where on the internet can people find you and get your stuff?
So we have the book's called A Return to Healing and the website is called areturntohealing.com. Mm-hmm. So that's it. We have a lot of articles we've written are on there as well. Some sample chapters and ways and just a lot of, we have blogs and videos and other things you can get just on the website. And you could talk to us as well. And then if you want to order the book, that's on there too. But there's a lot of other information on there as well.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I'll put the links for that down in the show notes and the caption below. So if you're listening and you want to learn more, read the book, get into this world, or get your shovel out and start digging your own rabbit hole, then the links are in the show notes down below. And I guess to round out this conversation, because I actually believe we could probably talk for 8 hours, what's one piece of health advice that you wish more people knew about?
I think the biggest piece of health is that you just need to know that you could eat and exercise and live your way to good health. And people don't believe it because of this number obsession we have. So the one piece of health advice is don't worry about the numbers. I mean, worry about how you feel. And often how you feel is how your body's doing. So I always say the people with the best numbers, my patients with the best numbers are often the sickest patients I have, and vice versa. People who feel well, who have energy, who are exercising, their brains are working well, generally don't have the best numbers, but they're feeling great and they live the longest. So, and that's the big barometer of your health is how you're feeling. Don't get bamboozled into this numbers game because it's not going to do you good.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks so much for your time and this conversation and all the work that you do. I think it's awesome.
Oh, you too. And thank you for all the stuff you do. And we need more people like you out there to impact people. So I really appreciate being on.
Yeah, you're welcome. We'll chat soon.
Okay, take care.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.